He says, he said this out loud, and I'm quoting, engineers are like batteries. When they burn out, you just go get more.
Hey, this is Dave Pryor. You're about to listen to my interview with Alan Daly, who's back to talk about quarterly planning, what it's supposed to be, how it is often not what it's supposed to be, why it goes wrong, how you can fix it, and most importantly, why developers are not like batteries. But before we get into that, I have two quick announcements. The first is that I'm very psyched to announce that this summer at Agile 2024 in Dallas, I will be back to doing podcasts live from the conference all week long. I'm going to be doing them for the Agile Alliance. Now, if you're able to attend in person, I highly recommend it because this is always an awesome experience. For 5 straight days, you're going to be fully immersed in a community of people who are dedicated to finding new and better ways to bring Agile practices to the world of work. They have a bunch of new events happening, like the Agile Executive Forum. They're bringing back the young professional stuff. There's a renewed focus on technical topics. There's going to be a lot going on. And you can learn all about it at agilealliance.org/agile2024. And I'm happy to announce that I am now able to offer advanced certified Scrum product owner classes. So if you're a CSPO and you're looking for a way to raise your game or demonstrate an advanced level of proficiency in your craft, advanced CSPO is a great way to do that. The course is 2 full days of highly interactive group work that will help you raise your PO game to a new level. And you can learn more about it and all the classes I teach at drunkenpm.com. All right, now, let's see if we can find out why everyone keeps making such a dumpster fire of quarterly planning and what we can do to fix it. Hey, this is Dave Pryor. Welcome to the Reluctant Agilist. Alan Daly's back. Alan, thank you for coming back and subjecting yourself to this mess once again.
Oh, well, I appreciate being invited back, surprisingly enough. We always have good conversations, and I enjoy spending some time with you, Dave.
Me too. And especially I'm glad because Alan's the ringer that I'm bringing in to solve a problem I've been struggling with and trying to find people to talk about for over a year. I did get to do a podcast with Nigel Baker, where we talked about it a little bit, but Alan is actually certified to have this conversation.
Yes.
Sort of. Well, he is certified to have the conversation, but we're going to talk about a problem that I see with a certain type of planning. But before we get into it, Alan, would you mind telling these fine people about what you do and kind of why you're in the giant library?
Well, okay, this is just my background screen here. That's Trinity College Library in Dublin, and I had the pleasure of going to Dublin several times for a particular company that had offices there, and they always wanted me to do their training.
So wow, that's great.
That's an endorsement and made me happy. So I was able to go visit some things in Dublin on those trips.
Cool.
I was a software engineer for more than 2 decades.
Okay.
And worked in that world and then discovered Agile and thought, hey, this is the human side of technology work. And so I shifted to be a Scrum Master, then Agile Coach. And and I worked for companies together and consulting and Agile coaching companies. And I've been doing that for, I don't know, 15 years or so, something like that.
Okay.
Much of that, I think more than half of it by now, involves work in the scaled Agile framework, which might trigger some people, but we're going to talk about that today.
Yes.
And
it's going to be all kinds of triggering up in here today.
Right, right. And so I'm really excited. The Agile Manifesto, the principles, those kinds of behaviors, Agile ways of working, I think, are among the best to have us get the best results and to enjoy doing it. The trick is, how do we get organizations to embrace those principles instead of just doing the motions? So,
and just to throw a little bit of empathy towards those organizations, they were built to work in the shadow of Frederick Taylor, which solved a problem we had in 1900. So it's easy to blame the companies. It's easy to blame Frederick Taylor, but they were built to solve a problem. It's just not the problem we have anymore. So they need to be rebuilt, and that could take a while.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. And I have full sympathy for the job of leadership and management, right? An Agile coach shows up and says, hey, you know all that stuff you've been doing for 24 years that got you in that seat of authority? You need to stop doing that.
Yeah, right. This is how you got your Porsche. It doesn't work.
Right. You know, that's kind of the trick, or the really key to agile coaching is not implementing stuff. It's how do I get that person to accept this new way of working? And am I good at that? That's what agile coaches should be asking themselves, not whether or not they know how to run a daily stand-up.
All right. But on those along those lines, we're going to talk about how to run something else or run it into the ground.
Sure.
So I'm going to pitch this scenario because I've run into this several times over the last year plus. Okay. Teaching or coaching at a company, I find out they do either PI planning or quarterly planning. Sometimes they're not sure if there's a difference between those things.
Okay.
But the way that this works, which I know, I think you're going to be able to tell us is not how it's supposed to work.
Okay.
The way that it works is management says, here's what we need you to do in the next gigantic time box. And the teams that are working are still trying to finish all the work from the last gigantic time box that was overplanned. And they don't feel like they have the agency to say no. They don't have the time to figure out the new stuff. So they just say yes. The gigantic time box arrives. They're still finishing up work from previous. They finally get to the new stuff, which is usually a couple weeks into the new gigantic time box. And they go, oh my gosh, this is so much worse and bigger than we thought. We're never going to finish it. So I would say to those people, well, why do you keep over planning? Why do you keep agreeing to do this stuff? And the response is, we have to. And then I'll say, but you know you can't do it, right? And they're like, well, we have to. I'm like, yeah, but you've never done it, right? And they're like, we have to. So there's this like insanity loop in there that I don't understand. I don't think this is how PI planning is supposed to work, because Dean's a really smart guy, and I can't imagine he would create a system that would work this way. And you are my safe ringer.
Right. Yeah. So let's talk about PI planning for a bit and what is it supposed to be? And then we can come back around to this scenario, because I think this scenario is
simple. Reeks of dysfunction.
Yeah, it's simple to understand, but hard to implement that simplicity. But we'll get back around to that. So in Scaled Agile Framework, they incorporate the idea of big room planning and quarterly planning.
Right.
And they call that it's now called a planning increment. And so they have a PI planning event, which means it's a planning increment planning event.
So this would be like many, many teams.
Yeah. So the idea is that you have a team of teams that Safe calls an agile release train to do to incorporate a metaphor in there.
Is there a size limit on that? Like more than this, less than that?
They talk about 125 people total.
Okay.
And in my experience, you can probably get up to about 150, but it gets really messy when you get more than that. And so you have this team of teams, around 125 people, that are feeding a value stream.
Okay.
They're supporting a value stream. Feeding maybe is the wrong word, but they're supporting a value stream. They're supporting the technology that enables a value stream, a customer journey through. And one of the analogies they use that's really fairly easy to understand for most people is if I'm a customer of a bank and I want to get a loan, there's a whole journey I go through to get that loan and then to pay it off. The journey doesn't end when I get the loan. I have to pay it off, right? From the bank's perspective, that's where they get their money. So that's part of the journey or the value stream. And so there might be four or five different computer systems that support that entire journey, all the way from you know, assessing credit and underwriting to actually issuing the loan and collecting payments and all that kind of stuff. And so you have technology people who are doing the development value stream to support the operational value stream and that customer journey.
So there might be a team for each one of those components you just mentioned, or multiple teams for each component.
A team or multiple teams. And so,
but they're all orchestrating this together because they're collectively producing a service.
Right. From the customer's point of view, from the customer centric point of view, the customer doesn't care what the systems are or whatever. They're going on a journey, and it might cross system boundaries or organizational boundaries, but I see those crosses, you know, okay, the loan was given to me. Now I have to work with the payment part.
Right.
But I don't know who's behind that. And I don't need to know. Yeah. I'm the customer. But there could be lots of teams behind there and different systems, different agile right. release trains that pick up that journey.
And they support. Need to coordinate all their work. Yeah. Well, that makes sense.
Yeah. So here I have a team of teams that needs to plan together. And mm-hmm. why is that? Well, it's because it's a lot of work. It's a big system. There's right. a lot of interaction between this and that and the other. We have to handle different sources of data, all that kind of stuff.
And a lot of that in the past would have been handled by a project manager and a bunch of tech leads or architects.
Right. They would be okay. trying to handle that on their own and then just informing the teams of here's yeah. how you do it. Right. The big room planning idea is that you can take and Scaled Agile Framework suggests 2 days.
Okay.
Of those 2 days, they suggest 5 hours as actual teams planning stuff. And the idea okay. is that you have all the teams in a big ballroom or something. And right. when my team comes up with something that is a dependency that your team is working on or has a question that I need from your team or whatever, we're all in the same room. I can walk over and talk to you. And so these dependencies and technical difficulties, we try to work them all out in these 2 days so that we don't get distracted by them later when we're trying to build the things for the next 3 months.
Okay. So can I check in with you on something about this?
Yeah.
So part of my, and this is coming from my interviews I've done with Dean and my study of SAFe, which I'm not, I took one, I think the only SAFe training I took was the one Evan gave at that retreat that we were at.
Yeah, years ago. Yeah.
I was horrible to him the whole time. I feel like Agile took all the project management away, or most of the project management away. And when I look at SAFe, especially the earlier models, I felt like Dean went and got all those tools and brought them back into the room because people still needed those questions answered. Mm-hmm. And so stuff like this, where you are trying to deal with the dependencies up front, figure out how you're going to coordinate things up front, it kind of has the whiff of project management applied in an agile context.
Yeah, that's one of you're speaking of it in positive terms, which is great. There's also people who speak of that in negative terms.
In very negative terms, yeah. SAFe isn't
agile because it does all this upfront stuff and whatever.
Yeah.
So there are companies out there that have product streams or value streams and systems that were built in the old mega way, right?
Yeah.
So, for example,
in the before times.
Right. I'm a coach. I go into a company.
Yeah.
This is a true scenario, but it wasn't as huge a company as some are. But I go into a company and they release once a year. Mm-hmm. And they brought me on because they're like, we're sick of spending 4 to 6 weeks of hardening and missing our release deadline because yeah. we integrate once a year. And I would suggest that it would have been detrimental to me to say to them, oh, you should be releasing every 2 weeks.
Well, they can't. So,
because they can't.
We should stay. Let's stay on this one for a second. Because yeah. I think it's easy for people, especially those that have already drank all the Kool-Aid, to say, yeah, you have to do that. But the work to get from where they are to a place where they can release every 2 weeks or every day or whatever. You know, I always used to do podcasts where we talk about the fat guy on the couch. So, a guy on the couch who's extremely overweight, living on a diet of Fritos and Dr. Pepper, who never exercises, can't just go run a marathon. And this company with this legacy way of work, of managing their work where all the systems are tightly coupled and you have the cultural underpinnings as well, can't just switch to 2 week sprints.
Right. And that's kind of my point is that yes, the ideal is release every 2 weeks or release 14 times a day or 1,000 times a day.
But they're not there yet.
But they're
and
not there.
They may not need it from a business perspective.
Right. Their market might not accept it. Their system is just simply that large and just takes mm-hmm. a lot of work to get together. So, I mean, there's reasons why project manager kind of stuff needs to exist.
I had a student in class last week who said that they had gotten to the point where they could release every day, but they had to stop doing it because it messed up the client.
Yeah,
I mean, handle it.
I've had a client in the past that we were doing, the group I was working with were doing call center stuff. Uh-huh. And the call center people says, we're not going to update and retrain everybody every 2 weeks. We're just not going to do that.
Yeah.
Right. And so we had to come up with ways to still be agile on the technical side, but serve our business customers, internal business customers, in a way that wasn't disruptive to them. So my point, I guess, here is that if I go into an organization that struggles to do an annual release, the idea of releasing every quarter or only planning in one quarter instead of an entire year is probably a big enough leap that it's difficult for them and valuable enough if they can get it, right?
And it's not like the winning state is not achieving agility. The winning state is being able to deliver for your client and provide value for them.
Right. So if I can go from annual release to quarterly, or go from annual planning to quarterly planning, that's a win. Mm-hmm. And hopefully it's a step to more
wins. That's you smoking cigarettes but not doing heroin anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, kind of exactly, I guess. So we come to a PI planning event.
Yeah.
We're going to plan a quarter. There is nothing in SAFE, in my opinion, in my reading of it, my coaching of it, there is nothing in SAFE that if I'm going to plan a quarter of 2 week iterations.
So you do plan all the sprints up front.
So the idea is, yes, we want to plan the sprints, but it's not reasonable for us to say, you know exactly what's going to happen in the last half of the fifth sprint from now.
Okay.
It's a
rough idea based on what information we have right now. Okay.
So one of the rules, wrong, too strong word. One of the coaching ideas that I provide people and I think is useful is that when you're done with your PI planning event, you probably have sprint iteration one and iteration two pretty well planned out.
Yeah.
Three is a little more vague. Four is probably not that much.
And after
five,
that, it's just a pile of stuff.
Right. But if there is something critical, like your team says to me, we really need this thing in sprint five. Mm-hmm. Then I probably should have planned that. Maybe I haven't planned all of my iteration five, but I should have looked at the critical things, because the PI planning event, the focus there is the interactions between teams.
Okay.
I shouldn't be spending too much time on the stuff that my team can handle completely by ourselves.
Yeah.
Or mostly by ourselves. I should be focused on and working with the other teams, because we're here present with each other for 2 days.
Let's so it's sure about a group of teams coordinating work so that they can deliver something coherent by the end of the time box.
Yes.
Okay.
So the thing I wanted to get to with your scenario, and we'll see where we go from here, is that the content authority, the idea of content authority, in other words, who has the authority to decide what the content is in a feature, which is a big chunk, a biggish chunk of work that takes more than an iteration, or in a user story.
So you would go, I just want to make sure, because this is different for different people.
Right.
You would go feature, story, task, or subtask. Right.
Yes. So in SAFE, they have the work of defining the work is set out in usually three levels. They call it an epic.
Okay.
An epic.
That's the highest level. That's the biggest
level. That's the biggest level.
That's Lord of the Rings.
Right. It's something that's going to take several months or even maybe a year and a half or something like that, right, to do completely. And features are split out from that epic, a feature with a capital F. It's a piece of work that one team of teams or one agile release train can do in one PI.
Oh.
Is a feature.
Okay.
If it's bigger than then it's an epic, or you need to split it.
All right. And the features become stories.
And the features split out stories. And any one story, of course, is one team can do in one iteration.
Okay.
Is the maximum size.
Okay.
Right. And then if you're doing tasks and all that stuff, okay, fine. But in SAFE, you have these three levels.
Got it.
So we can look at them as like stories are kind of ground level or maybe 1,000 feet, because tasks are maybe ground level if you use tasks.
Yeah.
And then,
or stories are deliverable things.
Yes.
That become part of collections of things that provide the overall service we're going to deliver.
Yes.
Okay.
So we have these six stories.
I'm with you.
Create or build this feature, and these three features create or build this epic or part of this epic.
Yep.
The reason for those boundaries, there's all kinds of reasons you can have those boundaries, positive and negative, of course. And I expect we'll see hear comments on how negative that is, but it's fine. From the positive side, we're trying to create containers of content authority.
Yeah.
The people who are defining epics do not define features.
Okay.
The people who define features do not define stories.
Okay.
So the product owner who is in charge of stories is the content authority for what is a story, what does it contain, when is it done.
Okay.
And then at the art level, at the Agile Release Train level, with the features, you have a product management function. It might be one person product manager, but it might be three people that are product managers, whatever. But they're the ones who are defining what the features are.
So in the scenario I gave, there's a product in your... what you're talking about, there's some product manager who is saying to the team of teams, this is the feature we need in the next PI.
Correct.
And in the scenario I gave, the team is just saying yes. Team of teams is just saying yes without actually doing the PI planning because they're too busy working to do PI planning.
Yeah. So they're not, and we can go into how you prepare for PI planning, all that stuff in a minute, but what I'm trying to say is there's these boundaries. SAFe has these boundaries defined so that at each level, the people at that level can be the decision makers and can be the owners of the results.
Okay.
If I have a manager, product manager, whatever, who is dictating to the teams, thou shalt build these things by this date.
Right.
If I fail as a team, it's like, well, it's not my fault.
Well, okay, so this, before we go into the how do you prepare for, this has become for me, I kind of shifted my thinking on it because in the beginning I was thinking like, oh, these horrible companies and horrible managers are just pushing crap downhill at these teams. But the more that I think about it and the more that I would talk to the people on these teams who were, for whatever reason, saying, okay, you tell me I have to eat 700 donuts in 10 minutes or you're going to fire me. So I say, okay, I will eat 700 donuts in 10 minutes, ignoring the fact that I have a gluten intolerance and that my stomach's not big enough for 700 donuts and nobody could ever do that, but I'm afraid of getting fired. So I say, yes. And to me, that is the moment where the thing that is most dangerous in the organization becomes the team itself, because the team is knowingly saying, yeah, we'll do that. And they know they won't, but they won't admit it because they're too scared, because maybe the culture's unsafe or whatever. I'm not discounting that.
Right.
Just if you're on a team that and you're trying to be a good steward of the company, a responsible employee of the company, team of teams, whatever. If you don't say no, that is the most irresponsible thing you can do for the company. And if you have 100 teams in the company, no wonder stuff's completely messed up.
So, yes. So, I mean, I agree with you that we want teams and team members to be professional, right? The analogy I use, and I probably used, maybe I've said this on some other episode before, but like, I don't go to the dentist and say, hey, would you just skip the x-rays and skip sterilizing the instruments? I don't have time for that. Just get to work on my teeth. And the dentist will kick me out.
I would say skip the drill part.
Right. The dentist will say, no, that's unprofessional. It's unsafe.
Yeah.
I'm not going to work on you. And so we have some companies and the industry as a whole, sometimes we seem to have created an environment where I, as an engineer or tester or whatever my technical skill is, I'm not allowed to be professional. I'm not allowed to do what I know needs to be done in order to have great
results. You don't feel you have the agency to do it.
Yeah, I don't have the agency. And so we ask, I as a trainer, sometimes, I emphasize that Scrum has this thing, this value of courage, right?
Yeah.
We're asking people to be courageous and talk about the reality, not talk about what people want to hear. And that's hard to do in many organizations.
Yes.
So,
but I like what you said about the professionalism, because to me, a part of my head is stuck in Christopher Avery's responsibility process right now, and the other part is in professionalism, because it's literally your job to say you can't do it.
Right, right. But there are organizations, for example, years ago when I was doing training, in fact, it was for that company that took send me to Dublin sometimes, but they would also often send me to New Jersey.
I'm sorry.
So I was in a training. There's a manager there, a director, with some of his people in the class. And he said out loud to me, no, we don't we can drive our people and they don't have to be sustainable when we're talking about sustainable pace, you know. We don't have to be sustainable. I says, why not? He says,
we got new ones.
He says, he said this out loud, and I'm quoting, engineers are like batteries. When they burn out, you just go get more.
Damn.
Okay. So, so the company scenario that you're talking about, I would be interesting to observe, to have conversations.
Yeah.
There are some managers that believe you have to force people to do more than they can just so that they will do what they can.
Well, that's what Steve Jobs did, right?
Maybe it works, maybe it doesn't, but it's not an agile thing to be unsustainable. Mm-hmm. And it's not
it doesn't create a healthy environment for people to thrive in.
Right, and it's not an agile thing. It's not a safe thing, right? One of the safe lean agile principles, they call it, is to decentralize decision-making. Mm-hmm. And so we need to operate in a way that allows people to still meet the business goals, but they get to make choices on how to get there.
Yeah. They have to know what the business goals are too. That's
correct. That's part of how we enable them to make those choices. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And so, so the scenario you're talking about, I'm wondering, you know, do we have a management culture there where they actually believe they have to push people to do more than they can just so they can get the bare minimum out of them or something like that?
Right. So the vibe that I got in both cases was not that. It was that management was asking for the stuff that made sense from them from a strategic standpoint to ask for. And if I from the interactions that I had at these companies, I feel like if I sat down with one of those managers and said, like, do you really want them to lie to you and just say yes? They'd be like, of course not. Tell us the truth so we can run the business. But they're... If you're juggling babies and I ask you what time your watch says it is, you can't tell me what time it is. You're too busy doing something else, right?
Yeah.
So these people on these teams did not have the ability to figure out how to answer that question.
Oh, yeah, of course not.
And I think that's where the breakdown was occurring. And I don't know why nobody was seemingly they're all unaware of it, but.
Yeah, it's probably something that everybody is the culture, right? We always talk about culture, and maybe culture is the wrong word here, but the culture is to ignore the reality that we don't know. In an environment where you're
because you're not going to get all this stuff
done. But what I'm saying is in an environment where teams are required to commit to more than they can deliver.
Yes.
They cannot learn or know how much they can deliver.
Okay, yeah, very true. Yeah.
It's not possible because we have yet to make a plan that matched what we could deliver. We have yet to plan against data that shows us how much we can deliver. So we really don't know how much we can deliver.
And if they stop to try, they're absolutely dooming themselves to failure because they stopped working to figure out if they could do a thing. Because the planning is not perceived as productive time. It's not perceived as work.
Yes.
We don't allocate space for it. We just say, go now, build the thing. And you're like, but I don't even know what I'm doing. Well, build it anyway. You're a professional.
Yeah. So if I go down to the team level, right, and in my coaching career, when I was coaching teams directly, I had two teams that consistently planned too much in their iteration. Mm-hmm. And so then their velocity, you know, they were using story points. Their velocity was like, wow, all over the place. They had no idea what their actual normal velocity throughput capacity was. And so two times I put my foot down, as it were, as the coach. And I said, how much did we finish in the last sprint? Well, we only got two stories done for a total of 8 points okay, in this sprint planning meeting, we're going to plan 8 points. Oh, no, we can't do that. We can't. No, that's what we're going to do. We're going to plan 8 points. And if we get done with that before the end of the sprint, that's fine because we can pull more in. But we have to go on the data we have so that we can learn what the data is.
Yeah. You're pointing at something else, though, I think is really important for organizations and teams to consider is it's not really about points. It's not about hours. It's about, did you meet your commitment? Like that, I think that there's just a general hangover from waterfall where people don't see that as the most important thing. But if you can't get the team predictable, the business can't plan. The business can't plan, the business can't run.
Yes. And so I would say you can only become predictable if you look at your results.
Yeah.
You can't become predictable by planning more or getting more accurate or whatever.
Yeah. Or hoping really hard.
Or hoping really hard. You have to say, what was our results?
Yeah.
Based on that, we can plan the next chunk. It's not going to be perfect or exact, but we're looking for like 80%, right? 80 to 100%.
Well, can you just be better than you were last time?
Right.
Even the slightest bit.
Right.
Yeah.
And so getting back to PI planning.
Yeah.
In the PI planning event, the teams are supposed to be looking at their velocity and only loading their iterations to fill their velocity capacity. How much can get done in an iteration and in the whole PI? Answering that question is that the answer to that question is owned by the teams, not by managers and product management.
So I want to interrupt for a second. So that means you can't predict a team's velocity. I have a lot of people tell me they're going to tell the teams what their velocity is going to be. And I'm assuming, because I would like all the poor lean people to stop spitting on themselves after what you just said,
right,
they could also be using flow metrics if they wanted to. Okay.
Yeah. Recent changes to Scaled Agile, they're emphasizing flow a lot.
Okay.
And, you know, whether that's disingenuous or not is for other people to decide, but it's there.
It's a different religious war than we're having right now.
Right.
Yeah.
So the teams are supposed to be, they're supposed to, okay, so there's, let me back up a little bit. There's
five. Sorry, there's the lean thing got everything all twisted up, my apologies.
Okay, there's five questions we want to answer.
Okay.
As a business, right?
Okay.
Who, what, when, why, and how? Okay?
Okay.
How is owned by the people doing the work to build it.
Yeah.
Who will work, they decide which person will work on what, how long it will take, what technology is used, those kinds of things are in the how question.
Yeah.
The what and the why and the who all influence the how, but all four of those influence when. You cannot know when without input from who, what, why, and how. All four of them influence the when.
Okay.
So if I, as a manager, decide when something will be done, I am ignoring the people who need to figure out how.
But they're batteries.
But they're batteries, yeah. But they're batteries. So this is the thing that we have to keep in mind is that many organizations and probably the company scenario that you're offering is that that they're ignoring the how input into the when. When will it be done? All of those questions influence when.
And I'm still trying to give the organization a little bit of the benefit of the doubt. I struggle to believe that there's a manager who gets up in the morning and thinks, I'm just going to decide this and put this on their backs and they're going to figure out how to carry it. Because it's not like some Disney story about a horrible creature that has to be overthrown. I think that they're acting with best intent and they're saying like, and I've done this to teams in the past earlier in my career, like, can you do this? You can do this, right? You got to tell me if you can't. I need you to tell me. Mm-hmm. All right, we're good. Right. And it's just like this anchoring thing that leaves them no, you might be thinking you're asking them the question, but you're not creating a space. And I guess that would be the thing I would hope leadership that's listening would be worried about coming out of this is, are you creating an environment where the teams feel not only that it's okay to say no, but it's their obligation?
Yes. Yeah. You need to create that environment through actions, not words. Right. You need another story, right? At a company I started coaching at, they were doing quarterly planning already.
Okay.
The work I did was change the way they did quarterly planning. But here I come to the quarterly planning. There's a presentation by marketing and sales and the leaders. Here's what we need this quarter. And the C I can't remember what his title was. It wasn't CTO, but it could have been.
C something or other.
Yeah. He stood up the front. He says, you all need to, these 2 days, you need to plan this so you get all of this done.
Welcome to Animal Farm. Yeah.
Right. The next quarterly planning, we changed it the way it's done completely. And leading up to that quarterly planning, I was doing lots of coaching, lots of working with leadership, all that kind of stuff. And they stood up there, and this time that person stood up there, the same person. He said, okay, here's all the things we want. You all need to tell me how much you can give us.
Yeah, much better.
And that's a shift that needs to happen. Now, it could be, you said, the managers are not waking up trying to be tyrants.
Right.
But they might they might be waking up saying, oh, man, in order for us to survive in this market, we really need all of this stuff right away.
Yeah.
Right. They're feeling market pressure or some pressure from somewhere that's telling them we have to do all this stuff. They might truly believe that.
I remember when I was doing traditional project management, if we had some kind of, and this happened many times, unrealistic timeline, the question was, okay, I have an unlimited amount of money that I can spend on this. What's it going to take to get me this by this date? And I could level the whole thing out so nobody was overworked. And I would go back and say, okay, we need 17 new engineers tomorrow. And they'd be like, hire them. And then it would take 4 months to hire them and we'd be totally screwed.
Right.
So I don't even think that that's a bad question. It's just not a good question because it never works out that way. You can't just flip a switch and have all those engineers show up.
True.
So that's the thing, is you got to work with what you have and figure out what you can deliver while you're trying to find those other 17 people.
The one thing I wanted to make sure we touched on as far as PI planning goes and SAFe and all that stuff is we talked about these different levels, right? The epic, the feature, the story.
Yep.
In SAFe, the way it's trained and the way it's defined, epics and features define the needs of the user or the needs of the company.
Mm-hmm.
They don't define how it shall be done.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They don't even define thou shalt use a mobile app.
Right.
Right.
Just the outcome we're looking for.
They define the outcome with acceptance criteria and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
So that when you get down to the ground level or just above the ground level at the user stories, product owners can be content authority about how do I create this outcome that's defined in this feature.
Okay. Yeah.
I can decide, is it 5 stories? Is it 6 stories? Is it 3 stories? What is the acceptance criteria? Is it a mobile app? Is it responsive? Is it this? Is it that?
Sure.
With input from my technical people, right? So there's decisions that we can make at that level. Because what gets defined to us is not a thou shalt build this thing. It's a, we want this outcome. Please build something that creates this outcome.
And not necessarily, please build this thing that gives me all of these things in this amount of time with the people that you have.
Correct. It's like you have to tell us. Yeah.
It's that 700 donuts.
Here's this outcome. You get to tell us how many iterations is that? How many PIs is that?
Yeah. All right. So I guess the thing, I mean, you've kind of already given it, but for the people at the management level, if you are working in a company where your quarterly planning or your PI planning, where the teams just never, ever meet the deadline or the goal that's set, rather than pushing harder, am I correct in thinking that the smarter thing to do would be maybe take your foot off the gas and ask the teams, what can we actually get by this time period?
Yes.
And then start to track metrics around ability to meet commitment.
Yes.
Instead of how many points or how many hours.
Yes.
because that's the predictability that we're actually, is it what we actually want?
Right. And it's, Yes. SAFe has this idea of PI objectives.
Okay.
That at the end of the PI planning event, you have business objectives to achieve, not a list of things to build.
Okay.
And you're communicating with your business owners, the stakeholders, about these objectives. Are these the objectives you need? This is what you want.
Yeah.
And you even talk about how valuable they are. So that when we get to the end of the PI, we talk about how much value did we actually deliver versus what we thought we could deliver.
Uh-huh. Okay. And versus how many points.
Right. And this is called the ART predictability measure.
This is awesome.
It's in SAFe. It's a thing, right? It's a metric to do.
Yep. So what if people who are watching this are thinking, man, that was awesome. I need to call Alan and have him come fix my SAFe because it's all broken. How can they reach you?
You can reach me on LinkedIn, of course, Alan Daly.
Okay.
You can also reach me at my own company email, which is ALANDD@dailyagile.com.
All right. I am. This is a big deal for me. I'm really grateful to you for doing this because I've been trying to find somebody who knew what they were talking about and was brave enough to have the conversation with me.
Great. Yes. Yes. So I look forward to all the people who tell me that I'm wrong and that I'm right, and we can talk about more SAFe stuff.
That is the joy of Agile. There's no shortage of people who want to smack you down for trying.
Right.
So
this was good. Thank you, Dave. I appreciate
it. Cool. Really. Thank you, man. Thanks for being here.
All right.